Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. And that was the most false thing, the biggest lie of all. Chapter 6. Peace had deserted Devon. Although not in the look of the campus and village, they retained much of their dreaming summer calm. Fall had barely touched the full splendor of the trees, and during the height of the day, the sun briefly regained its summertime power. In the air, there was only an edge of coolness to imply the coming winter. But all had been caught up, like the first fallen leaves, by a new, energetic wind. The summer session, a few dozen boys being force-fed education, a stopgap, while most of the masters were away and most of the tradition stored against sultriness, the summer session was over. It had been the school's first, but this was its 163rd winter session, and the forces reassembled for it scattered the easy-going summer spirit like so many fallen leaves. The masters were in their places for the first chapel, seated in the stalls in front of and at right angles to us, suggesting by their worn expressions and careless postures that they had never been away at all. In the apse of the church sat the wives and children, the objects during the tedious winter months of our ceaseless ritual speculation. Why did he ever marry her? What in the world ever made her marry him? How could the two of them ever produce those little monsters? The masters favored seersucker in this mild first day. The wives broke out their hats. Five of the younger teachers were missing, gone into the war. Mr. Pike had come in his naval ensign's uniform. Some reflex must have survived midshipman's school and brought him back to Devon for the first day. His face was as mild and hopeless as ever. Mooning above the snappy, rigid blouse, it gave him the air of an impostor. Continuity was the keynote. The same hymns were played, the same sermon given, the same announcements made. There was one surprise. Maids had disappeared for the duration. A new phase then. But continuity was stressed. Not beginning again, but continuing the education of young men according to the unbroken traditions of Devon. I knew, perhaps I alone knew, that this was false. Devon had slipped through their fingers during the warm, overlooked months. The traditions had been broken, the standards let down, all rules forgotten. In those bright days of truancy, we had never thought of what we owed Devon, as the sermon this opening day exhorted us to do. We had thought of ourselves, of what Devon owed us, and we had taken all of that and much more. Today's hymn was, "Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, forgive our foolish ways." We had never heard that during the summer either. Ours had been a wayward gypsy music, leading us down all kinds of foolish gypsy ways, unforgiven. I was glad of it. I had almost caught the rhythm of it, the dancing, the clicking jangle of it during the summer. Still, it had come to an end. In the last long rays of daylight, at the tree, when Phineas fell. It was forced on me, as I sat chilled through the chapel service, that this probably vindicated the rules of Devon after all, wintry Devon. If you broke the rules, then they broke you. That, I think, was the real point of the sermon on this first morning. After the service ended, we set out 700 strong, the regular winter throng of the Devon School, to hustle through our lists of appointments. All classrooms were crowded. Swarms were on the crosswalks. The dormitories were as noisy as factories. Every bulletin board was a forest of notices. We had been an idiosyncratic, leaderless band in the summer, undirected except by the eccentric notions of Phineas. Now, the official class leaders and politicians could be seen taking charge, assuming as a matter of course their control of these walks and fields, which had belonged only to us. I had the same room which Finney and I had shared during the summer, But across the hall, in the large suite where Leper Lepellier had dreamed his way through July and August amidst sunshine and dust motes and windows through which ivy had reached tentatively into the room, here Brinker Hadley had established his headquarters. Emissaries were already dropping in to confer with him. Leper, luckless in his last year as all the others, had been moved to a room lost in an old building off somewhere in the trees toward the gym. After morning classes and lunch, I went across to see Brinker, started into the room, and then stopped. Suddenly, I did not want to see the trays of snails which Leper had passed the summer collecting replaced by Brinker's files. Not yet. Although it was something to have this year's dominant student across the way. Ordinarily, he should have been a magnet for me, the center of all the excitement and influences in the class. Ordinarily, this would have been so, if the summer, the gypsy days, had not intervened. Now Brinker, with his steady wit and ceaseless plans, Brinker had nothing to offer in place of Leper's dust motes and creeping ivy and snails. I didn't go in. In any case, I was late for my afternoon appointment. I never used to be late, but today I was, later even than I had to be. I was supposed to report to the crew house, down on the banks of the lower river. There are two rivers at Devon, divided by a small dam. On my way, I stopped on the footbridge, which crosses the top of the dam, separating them, and looked upstream at the narrow little Devon River sliding toward me between its thick fringe of pine and birch. As I had to do whenever I glimpsed this river, I thought of Phineas. Not of the tree and pain, but of one of his favorite tricks. Phineas, in exaltation, balancing on one foot on the prow of a canoe like a river god, his raised arms invoking the air to support him, his face transfigured, his body a complex set of balances and compensations, each muscle aligned in perfection with all the others to maintain this supreme fantasy of achievement, his skin glowing from immersions, his whole body hanging between river and sky, as though he had transcended gravity and might, by gently pushing upward with his foot, glide a little way higher and remain suspended in space, encompassing all the glory of summer and offering it to the sky. Then an infinitesimal veering of the canoe and the line of his body would break, the soaring arms collapse. Up shoot an uncontrollable leg, and Phineas would tumble into the water, roaring with rage. I stopped in the middle of this hurrying day to remember him like that, and then, feeling refreshed, I went on to the crew house beside the tidewater river below the dam. We had never used this lower river, the Neguamset, during the summer. It was ugly, saline, fringed with marsh, mud, and seaweed. A few miles away, it was joined to the ocean, so that its movements were governed by unimaginable factors like the Gulf Stream, the polar ice cap, and the moon. It was nothing like the fresh water Devon above the dam, where we had so much fun all the summer. The Devon's course was determined by some familiar hills a little inland. It rose among highland farms and forests which we knew, passed at the end of its course through the school grounds, and then threw itself with little spectacle over a small waterfall beside the diving dam and into the turbid Neguamset. The Devon School was astride these two rivers. At the crew house, Quackenbush, in the midst of some milling oarsmen in the damp main room, spotted me the instant I came in, with his dark, expressionless eyes. Quackenbush was the crew manager, and there was something wrong about him. I didn't know exactly what it was. In the throng of the winter terms at Devon, we were at opposite extremities of the class, and to me there only came the disliked edge of Quackenbush's reputation. A clue to it was that his first name was never used. I didn't even know what it was. And he had no nickname, not even an unfriendly one.
"Late Forrester,"
he said in his already matured voice. He was a firmly masculine type. Perhaps he was disliked only because he had matured before the rest of us.
"Yes, sorry. I got held up."
The crew waits for no man.
He didn't seem to think this was a funny thing to say. I did, and had to chuckle.
Well, if you think it's all a joke...
I didn't say it was a joke.
I've got to have some real help around here. This crew is going to win the New England Scholastics, or my name isn't Cliff Quackenbush.
With that blank filled, I took up my duties as the assistant senior crew manager. There is no such position officially, but it sometimes came into existence through necessity. It was the opposite of a sinecure. It was all work and no advantages. The official assistant to the crew manager was a member of the class below, and the following year, he could come into the senior managership with its rights and status. An assistant who was already a senior ranked nowhere. Since I had applied for such a non-entity of a job, Quackenbush, who had known as little about me as I had about him, knew now.
Get some towels,
he said without looking at me, pointing at the door. How many?
Who knows? Get some. As many as you can carry. That won't be too many.
Jobs like mine were usually taken by boys with some physical disability, since everyone had to take part in sports, and this was all disabled boys could do. As I walked toward the door, I suppose that Quackenbush was studying me to see if he could detect a limp. I knew that his flat, black eyes would never detect my trouble. Quackenbush felt mellower by the end of the afternoon as we stood on the float in front of the crew house, gathering up towels.
You never rowed, did you?
He opened the conversation like that, without pause or question mark. His voice sounded almost too mature, as though he were putting it on a little. He sounded as though he were speaking through a tube. No, I never did.
I rowed in the lightweight crew for 2 years.
He had a tough bantam body, easily detectable under the tight sweatshirt he wore.
I wrestle in the winter, he went on. What are you going to do in the winter?
I don't know. Manage something else.
You're a senior, aren't you?
He knew that I was a senior.
Yeah. Starting a little late to manage teams, aren't you?
Am I?
Damn right you are!
He put indignant conviction into this, pouncing on the first sprig of assertiveness in me. Well, it doesn't matter.
Yes, it matters!
I don't think it does.
Go to hell, Forrester. Who the hell are you, anyway?
I turned with an inward groan to look at him. Quackenbush wasn't going to let me just do the work for him like the automaton I wished to be. We were going to have to be pitted against each other. It was easy enough to see why, for Quackenbush had been systematically disliked since he first set foot in Devon, with careless, disinterested insults coming at him from the beginning, voting for and applauding the class leaders through years of attaining nothing he wanted for himself. I didn't want to add to his humiliations. I even sympathized with his trembling, goaded egotism he could no longer contain. The furious arrogance which sprang out now at the mere hint of opposition from someone he had at last found whom he considered inferior to himself. I realized that all this explained him. And it wasn't the words he said which angered me. It was only that he was so ignorant, that he knew nothing of the gypsy summer, nothing of the loss I was fighting to endure, of skylarks and splashes and petal-bearing breezes. He had not seen leper snails or the charter of the Super Suicide Society. He shared nothing, knew nothing, felt nothing, as Phineas had done. You, Quackenbush, don't know anything about who I am. That launched me, and I had to go on and say, or anything else.
Listen, you maimed son of a bitch!
I hit him hard across the face. I didn't know why for an instant. It was almost as though I were maimed. Then the realization that there was someone who was flashed over me. Quackenbush had clamped his arm in some kind of tight wrestling grip around my neck, and I was glad in this moment not to be crippled. I reached over, grasped the back of his sweatshirt, wrenched, and it came away in my hand. I tried to throw him off. He lunged at the same time, and we were catapulted into the water. The dousing extinguished Quackenbush's rage, and he let go of me. I scrambled back onto the float, still seared by what he had said. "The next time you call anybody maimed," I bit off the words harshly so he would understand all of them, "you better make sure they are first."
"Get out of here, Forrester,"
he said bitterly from the water.
"You're not wanted around here, Forrester. Get out of here."
I fought that battle, that first skirmish of a long campaign for Finney. Until the back of my hand cracked against Quackenbush's face, I had never pictured myself in the role of Finney's defender, and I didn't suppose that he would have thanked me for it now. He was too loyal to anything connected with himself, his roommate, his dormitory, his class, his school, outward in vastly expanded circles of loyalty, until I couldn't imagine who would be excluded. But it didn't feel exactly as though I had done it for Phineas. It felt as though I had done it for myself. If so, I had little profit to show, as I straggled back toward the dormitory, dripping wet, with a job I had wanted gone, temper gone, mind circling over and over through the whole soured afternoon. I knew now that it was fall, all right. I could feel it pressing clammily against my wet clothes. An unfriendly, discomforting breath in the air. An edge of wintry chill. Air that shriveled, soon to put out the lights on the countryside. One of my legs wouldn't stop trembling. Whether from cold or anger, I couldn't tell. I wished I had hit him harder. Someone was coming toward me along the bent, broken lane which led to the dormitory. A lane out of old London, ancient houses on either side, leaning as though soon to tumble into it. Cobblestones, heaving underfoot like a brick-over-ocean squall. A figure of great height advanced down them toward me. It could be only Mr. Ludsbury. No one else could pass over these stones with such contempt for the idea of tripping. The houses on either side were inhabited by, I didn't know who, wispy, fragile old ladies seemed most likely. I couldn't duck into one of them. There were angles and bumps and bends everywhere, but none big enough to conceal me. Mr. Ludsbury loomed on like a high-masted clipper ship in this rocking passage, and I tried to go stealthily by him on my watery, squeaking sneakers.
"Just a moment, Forrester, if you please."
Mr. Ludsbury's voice was bass, British, and his Adam's apple seemed to move as much as his mouth when he spoke.
"Has there been a cloudburst in your part of town?"
"No, sir. I'm sorry, sir. I fell into the river." I apologized by instinct to him for this mishap, which discomforted only me.
"And could you tell me how and why you fell into the river?"
"I slipped."
"Yes."
After a pause, he went on.
"I think you have slipped in any number of ways since last year. I understand, for example, there was gaming in my dormitory this summer while you were living there."
He was in charge of the dormitory. One of the dispensations of those days of deliverance, I realize now, had been his absence.
"Gaming? What kind of gaming, sir?"
"Cards, dice."
He shook his long hand dismissingly. "I didn't inquire. It didn't matter.
There won't be any more of it."
I don't know who that would have been.
Nights of blackjack and poker and unpredictable games invented by Phineas rose up in my mind. The back room of Leper's suite, a lamp hung with a blanket so that only a small blazing circle of light fell sharply amid the surrounding darkness. Phineas, losing even in those games he invented, betting always for what should win, for what would have been the most brilliant successes of all, if only the cards hadn't betrayed him. Finney finally betting his icebox and losing it, that contraption, to me. I thought of it because Mr. Ludsbury was just then saying,
"And while I'm putting the dormitory back together, I'd better tell you to get rid of that leaky icebox. Nothing like that is ever permitted in the dormitory, of course. I noticed that everything went straight to seed during the summer, and that none of you old boys who knew our standards so much as lifted a finger to help Mr. Prudham maintain order. As a substitute for the summer, he couldn't have been expected to know everything there was to be known at once.
You old boys simply took advantage of the situation. I stood there, shaking in my wet sneakers. If only I had truly taken advantage of the situation, seized and held and prized the multitudes of advantages the summer offered me. If only I had. I said nothing. On my face, I registered the bleak look of a defendant who knows the court will never be swayed by all the favorable evidence he has. It was a schoolboy look. Mr. Ludsbury knew it well. "There's a long-distance call for you," he continued in the tone of the judge performing the disagreeable duty of telling the defendant his right. "I've written the operator's number on the pad beside the telephone in my study. You may go in and call." "Thank you very much, sir." He sailed on down the lane without further reference to me, and I wondered who was sick at home. But when I reached his study, low-ceilinged, gloomy with books, black leather chairs, a pipe rack, frayed brown rug, a room which students rarely entered except for a reprimand, I saw on the pad not an operator's number from my hometown, but one which seemed to interrupt the beating of my heart. I called this operator, and listened in wonder while she went through her routine, as though this were just any long-distance call. And then her voice left the line, and it was preempted and charged by the voice of Phineas. "Happy first day of the new academic year!" "Thanks. Thanks a lot. It's, you sound..." "I'm glad to hear you. Stop stuttering. I'm paying for this. Who you rooming with?"
"Nobody. They didn't put anyone else in the room."
"Saving my place for me, good old Devon. But anyway, you wouldn't have let them put anyone else in there, would you?"
Friendliness, simple, outgoing affection. That was all I could hear in his voice.
"No, of course not." "I didn't think you would. Roommates are roommates, even if they do have an occasional fight. God, you were crazy when you were here."
"I guess I was. I guess I must have been."
"Completely over the falls. I wanted to be sure you recovered. That's why I called up. I knew that if you'd let them put anyone else in the room in my place, then you really were crazy. But you didn't. I knew you wouldn't." "Well, I did have just a trace of doubt, but that was because you talked so crazy here. I have to admit, I had just a second when I wondered." "I'm sorry about that, Gene. Naturally, I was completely wrong. You didn't let them put anyone else in my spot."
"No, I didn't let them.
I could shoot myself for thinking you might. I really knew you wouldn't."
"No, I wouldn't.
And I spent my money on a long-distance call. All for nothing. Well, it's spent. On you, too. So start talking, pal. And it better be good. Start with sports. What are you going out for?"
"Crew. Well, not exactly crew. Managing crew. Assistant crew manager."
"Assistant crew manager? I don't think I've got the job. Assistant crew manager?
I got in a fight this afternoon.
Assistant crew manager?"
No voice could course with dumbfoundment like Finney's.
"You are crazy."
"Listen, Finney, I don't care about being a big man on campus or anything."
"What?"
Much more clearly than anything in Mr. Ludsbury's study, I could see his face now, grimacing in wide, obsessed stupefaction.
"Who said anything about whoever they are?"
"Well then, what are you so worked up for?"
"What do you want to manage crew for? What do you want to manage for? What's that got to do with sports?"
The point was, the grace of it was, that it had nothing to do with sports. For I wanted no more sports. They are barred from me, as though when Dr. Stampole said, "Sports are finished," he had been speaking of me. I didn't trust myself in them. I didn't trust anyone else. It was as though football players were really bent on crushing the life out of each other, as though boxers were in combat to the death, as though even a tennis ball might turn into a bullet. This didn't seem completely crazy imagination in 1942, when jumping out of trees stood for abandoning a torpedoed ship. Later, in the school swimming pool, we were given the second stage of that rehearsal. After you hit the water, you made big splashes with your hands to scatter the flaming oil which would be on the surface. So to Phineas I said, "I'm too busy for sports." And he went into his incoherent groans and jumbles of words. And I thought the issue was settled, until at the end he said, "Listen, pal, if I can't play sports, you're going to play them for me." And I lost a part of myself to him then. And a soaring sense of freedom revealed this must have been my purpose from the first. To become a part of Phineas. Chapter 7. Brinker Hadlett came across to see me late that afternoon. I had taken a shower to wash off the sticky salt of the Neguamset River. Going into the Devon was like taking a refreshing shower itself. You never had to clean up after, but the Neguamset was something else entirely. I had never been in it before. It seemed appropriate that my baptism had taken place on the first day of this winter session, and that I had been thrown into it in the middle of a fight. I washed the traces off me and then put on a pair of chocolate brown slacks, a pair which Phineas had been particularly critical of when he wasn't wearing them, and a blue flannel shirt. Then, with nothing to do until my French class at 5 o'clock, I began turning over in my mind this question of sports. But Brinker came in. I think he made a point of visiting all the rooms near him the first day. "Well, Jean," his beaming face appeared around the corner. Brinker looked the standard preparatory school article in his gray gabardine suit with square, hand-sewn-looking jacket pockets, a conservative necktie, and dark brown cordovan shoes. His face was all straight lines, eyebrows, mouth, nose, everything, and he carried his 6 feet of height straight as well. He looked, but happened not to be, athletic, being too busy with politics, arrangements, and offices. There was nothing idiosyncratic about Brinker, unless you saw him from behind. I did, as he turned to close the door after him. The flaps of his gabardine jacket parted slightly over his healthy rump, and it is that, without any sense of derision at all, that I recall as Brinker's salient characteristic, those healthy, determined, not over-exaggerated, but definite and substantial buttocks.
"Here you are in your solitary splendor," he went on genially. "I can see you have real influence around here. This big room all to yourself. I wish I knew how to manage things like you."
He grinned confidingly and sank down on my cot, leaning on his elbow in a relaxed, at-home way.
It didn't seem fitting for Brinker Hadley, the hub of the class, to be congratulating me on influence. I was going to say that while he had a roommate, it was frightened Brownie Perkins, who would never impinge on Brinker's comfort in any way, and that they had two rooms, the front one with a fireplace. Not that I grudged him any of this. I liked Brinker, in spite of his winter session efficiency. Almost everyone liked Brinker. But in the pause I took before replying, he started talking in his light-hearted way again. He never let a dull spot appear in conversation if he could help it.
"I'll bet you knew all the time Finney wouldn't be back this fall. That's why you picked him for a roommate, right?"
"What?"
I pulled quickly around in my chair, away from the desk, and faced him.
"No, of course not. How could I know a thing like that in advance?"
Brinker glanced swiftly at me.
"You fixed it."
He smiled widely.
"You knew all the time. I bet it was all your doing."
"Don't be nutty, Brinker."
I turned back toward the desk and began moving books with rapid pointlessness.
"What a crazy thing to say!"
My voice sounded too strained, even to my own blood-pounded ears.
"Ah, the truth hurts, huh?"
I looked at him as sharply as eyes can look. He had struck an accusing pose.
"Sure."
I gave a short laugh. "Sure." Then these words came out of me by themselves. "But the truth will out." His hand fell leadenly on my shoulder.
"Rest assured of that, my son. In our free democracy, even fighting for its life, the truth will out."
I got up. I feel like a smoke, don't you? Let's go down to the butt room.
Yes, yes, to the dungeon with you!
The butt room was something like a dungeon. It was in the basement, or bowels, of the dormitory. There were about 10 smokers already there. Everyone at Devon had many public faces. In class, we looked, if not exactly scholarly, at least respectably alert. On the playing fields, we looked like innocent extroverts. In the butt room, we looked, very strongly, like criminals. The school's policy, in order to discourage smoking, was to make these rooms as depressing as possible. The windows near the ceiling were small and dirty. The old leather furniture spilled its innards. The tables were mutilated, the walls ash-colored, the floor concrete. A radio with a faulty connection played loud and rasping for a while, then suddenly quiet and insinuating.
"Here's your prisoner, gentlemen,"
announced Brinker, seizing my neck and pushing me into the butt room ahead of him.
"I'm turning him over to the proper authorities."
High spirits came hard in the haze of the butt room. A slumped figure near the radio, which happened to be playing loud at the moment, finally roused himself to say,
"What's the charge?"
"Doing away with his roommate so he could have the whole room to himself. Rankest treachery."
He paused impressively.
"Practically fratricide."
With a snap of the neck, I shook his hand off me, my teeth set.
"Brinker!"
He raised an arresting hand.
"Not a word, not a sound. You'll have your day in court."
"God damn it, shut up! I swear to God, you write a joke longer than anyone I know." It was a mistake. The radio had suddenly gone quiet, and my voice, ringing in the abrupt, releasing hush, galvanized them all.
"So, you killed him, did you?"
a boy uncoiled tensely from the couch.
"Well," Brinker qualified judiciously, "not exactly killed. Finney's hanging between life and death at home, in the arms of his grief-stricken old mother."
I had to take part in this, or risk losing control completely.
"I didn't do hardly a thing,"
I began as easily as it was possible for me to do. All I did was drop a little pinch of arsenic in his morning coffee."
"Liar!"
Brinker glowered at me.
"Trying to weasel out of it with a false confession, eh?"
I laughed at that. Laughed uncontrollably for a moment at that.
"We know the scene of the crime," Brinker went on. "High in that funereal tree by the river. There wasn't any poison, nothing as subtle as that."
"Oh, you know about the tree?"
I tried to let my face fall guiltily, but it felt instead as though it were being dragged downward.
Yes, there was a little contretemps at the tree."
No one was diverted from the issue by this try at a funny French pronunciation.
"Tell us everything,"
a younger boy at the table said huskily. There was an unsettling current in his voice, a genuinely conspiratorial note, as though he believed literally everything that had been said. His attitude seemed to me almost obscene, the attitude of someone who discovers a sexual secret of yours and promises not to tell a soul if you'll describe it in detail to him.
"Well," I replied in a stronger voice, "first, I stole all his money. Then I found that he cheated on his entrance tests to Devon, and I blackmailed his parents about that. Then I made love to his sister in Mr. Ludsbury's study. Then I..."
He was going well. Faint grins were appearing around the room. Even the younger boy seemed to suspect that he was being sincere about a joke. A bad mistake to make at Devon.
"Then
I only had to add, pushed him out of the tree, and the chain of implausibility would be complete.
Then I..."
Just those few words, and perhaps this dungeon nightmare would end. But I could feel my throat closing on them. I could never say them. Never. I swung on the younger boy.
"What did I do then?"
I demanded.
"I bet you've got a lot of theories. Come on, reconstruct the crime. There we were at the tree. Then what happened, Sherlock Holmes?"
His eyes swung guiltily back and forth.
"Then you just... pushed him off, I bet."
"Lousy bet," I said offhandedly, falling into a chair as though losing interest in the game.
"You lose. I guess you're Dr. Watson after all."
They laughed at him a little, and he squirmed and looked guiltier than ever. He had a very weak foothold among the buttroom crowd, and I had pretty well pushed him off it. His glance flickered out at me from his defeat, and I saw, to my surprise, that I had, by making fun of him, brought upon myself his unmixed hatred. For my escape, this was a price I was willing to pay.
"French! French!" I exclaimed. "Enough of this contretemps! I've got to study my French!"
And I went out. Going up the stairs, I heard a voice from the buttroom say, "Funny. He came all the way down here and didn't even have a smoke." But this was a clue they soon seemed to forget. I detected no Sherlock Holmes among them, nor even a Dr. Watson. No one showed any interest in tracking me. No one pried. No one insinuated. The daily list of appointments lengthened with the rays of the receding autumn sun until the summer, the opening day, even yesterday, became by the middle of October something gotten out of the way and forgotten, because tomorrow bristled with so much to do. In addition to classes and sports and clubs, there was the war. Brinker Hadley can compose his shortest war poem ever written. "The war is a bore," if he wanted to, but all of us had to take stronger action than that. First, there was the local apple crop, threatening to rot because the harvesters had all gone into the army or war factories. We spent several shining days picking them, and were paid in cash for it. Brinker was inspired to write his apple ode. "Our chore is the core of the war." And the novelty and the money of these days excited us. Life at Devon was revealed as still very close to the ways of peace. The war was at worst only a bore, as Brinker said, no more taxing to us than a day spent at harvesting in an apple orchard. Not long afterward, early even for New Hampshire, snow came. It came theatrically, late one afternoon. I looked up from my desk and saw that suddenly there were big flakes twirling down in the quadrangle, settling on the carefully pruned shrubbery bordering the sidewalks, the three elms still holding many of their leaves, the still green lawns. They gathered there, thicker by the minute, like noiseless invaders conquering because they took possession so gently. I watched them whirl past my window. "Don't take this seriously," the playful way they fell seemed to imply. "This little show, this harmless trick." It seemed to be true. The school was thinly blanketed that night. But the next morning, a bright, almost balmy day, every flake disappeared. The following weekend, however, it snowed again. Then, 2 days later, much harder. And by the end of that week, the ground had been clamped under snow for the winter. In the same way, the war, beginning almost humorously with announcements about maids and days spent at apple picking, commenced its invasion of the school. The early snow was commandeered as its advance guard. Leber Lepelier didn't suspect this. It was not, in fact, evident to anyone at first, but Leber stands out for me as the person who was most often and most emphatically taken by surprise by this and every other shift in our life at Devon. The heavy snow paralyzed the railroad yards of one of the large towns south of us on the Boston and Maine line. At chapel the day following the heaviest snowfall, 200 volunteers were solicited to spend the day shoveling them out as part of the emergency usefulness policy adopted by the faculty that fall. Again, we would be paid. So we all volunteered. Brinker and I and Chet Douglas, and even, I noticed, Quackenbush. But not Leper. He generally made little sketches of birds and trees in the back of his notebook during chapel, so that he had probably not heard the announcement. The train to take us south to work did not arrive until after lunch, and on my way to the station, taking a shortcut through a meadow not far from the river, I met Leper. I had hardly seen him all fall. I hardly recognized him now. He was standing motionless on the top of a small ridge, and he seemed from a distance to be a scarecrow left over from the growing season. As I plodded toward him through the snow, I began to differentiate items of clothing. A dull green deerstalker's cap, brown earmuffs, a thick gray woolen scarf. Then at last I recognized the face in the midst of them. lepers, pinched and pink, his eyes peering curiously toward some distant woods through steel-rimmed glasses. As I got nearer, I noticed that below his long, tan canvas coat with sagging pockets, below the red and black plaid woolen knickers and green puttees, he was wearing skis. They were very long, wooden and battered, and had two decorative old-fashioned knobs on their tips.
"You think there's a path through these woods?"
he asked in his mild, tentative voice when I got near. Leper did not switch easily from one train of thought to another, and even though I was an old friend who he had not talked to in months, I didn't mind his taking me for granted now, even at this improbable meeting in a wide, empty field of snow.
"I'm not sure, Leper, but I think there's one at the bottom of the slope." "Oh, yeah, I guess there is."
We always called him Leper to his face. He wouldn't have remembered to respond to any other name. I couldn't keep from staring at him, at this burlesque explorer look of him.
"What are you..."
I asked at last. "What are you doing anyway?"
"I'm touring."
"Touring?" I examined the long bamboo steeples he held.
"How do you mean, touring?" "Touring. It's the way you get around the countryside in the winter. Touring skiing. It's how you go overland in the snow."
"Where are you going?"
"Well, I'm not going anywhere."
He bent down to tighten the lacings on his puttee.
"I'm just touring around."
"There's that place across the river where you could ski. The place where they have the rope tow on that steep hill across from the railroad station. You could go over there."
"No, I don't think so."
He surveyed the woods again, although his breath had fogged his glasses.
"That's not skiing."
"Why, sure that's skiing. It's a good little run. You can get going pretty fast on that hill."
"Yeah, but that's it. That's why it isn't skiing. Skiing isn't supposed to be fast. Skis are for useful locomotion."
He turned his inquiring eyes on me.
"You can break a leg with that downhill stuff."
"Not on that little hill."
"Well, it's the same thing. It's part of the whole wrong idea. They're ruining skiing in this country. Rope tows and chair lifts and all that stuff. You get catted up and then you whiz down. You never get to see the trees or anything. Oh, you see a lot of trees shoot by, but you never get to really look at trees, at a tree. I just like to go along and see what I'm passing and enjoy myself."
He had come to the end of his thought, and now he slowly took me in, noticing my layers of old clothes.
"What are you doing anyway?"
he asked mildly and curiously. "Going to work on the railroad." He kept gazing mildly and curiously at me. "Shovel out those tracks. The work that they talked about in chapel this morning, you remember."
"Have a nice day at it anyway,"
he said.
"I will.
You too."
"I will if I find what I'm looking for. A beaver dam. It used to be up the Devon a ways, in a little stream that flows into the Devon. It's interesting to see the way beavers adapt to the winter. Have you ever seen it?"
"No, I never have seen that."
"Well, you might want to come sometime, if I find the place."
"Tell me if you find it." With Leper, it was always a fight, a hard fight to win when you were 17 years old and lived in a keyed-up competing school, to avoid making fun of him. But as I gotten to know him better, this fight had been easier to win. Shoving in his long bamboo poles, he pushed deliberately forward and slid slowly away from me down the gradual slope, standing very upright, his skis far apart to guard against any threat to his balance, his poles sticking out on either side of him, as though to ward off any interference. I turned and trudged off to help shovel out New England for the war. We spent an odd day toiling in that railroad yard. By the time we arrived there, the snow had become drab and sooted, wet and heavy. We were divided into gangs, each under an old railroad man. Brinker, Chet, and I managed to be in the same group, but the playful atmosphere of the apple orchard was gone. Of the town, we could only see some dull, red brick mills and warehouses surrounding the yards, and we labored away among what the old man directing us called rolling stock, grim freight cars from many parts of the country, immobilized in the snow. Brinker asked him if it shouldn't be called unrolling stock now, and the old man looked back at him with bleary dislike and didn't reply. Nothing was very funny that day. The work became hard and unvarying. I began to sweat under my layers of clothes. By the middle of the afternoon, we had lost our fresh volunteer look. The grime of the railroad and the exhaustion of manual laborers were on us all. We seemed of a piece with the railroad yards and the mills and the warehouses. The old man resented us. Or we made him nervous, or maybe he was as sick as he looked. For whatever reason, he grumbled and spat, and alternated between growling orders and rubbing his big, unhealthy belly. Around 4:30, there was a moment of cheer. The main line had been cleared, and the first train rattled slowly through. We watched it advance toward us, the engine throwing up balls of steam to add to the heavy overcast. All of us lined both sides of the track, and got ready to cheer the engineer and passengers. The coach windows were open, and the passengers, surprisingly, were hanging out. They were all men, I could discern, all young, all alike. It was a troop train. Over the clatter and banging of the wheels and couplings, we cheered, and they yelled back, both sides, taken by surprise. They were not much older than we were, and although probably just recruits, they gave the impression of being an elite, as they were carried past our drab ranks. They seemed to be having a wonderful time. Their uniforms looked new and good. They were clean and energetic. They were going places. After they had gone, we laborers looked rather emptily across the newly cleared rails at each other, at ourselves, and not even Brinker thought of a timely remark. We turned away. The old man told us to go back to other parts of the yard, but there was no more real work done that afternoon. Stranded in this mill town railroad yard, while the whole world was converging elsewhere, we seemed to be nothing but children playing among heroic men. The day ended at last. Gray from the beginning, its end was announced by a deepening gray of sky, snow, faces, spirits. We piled back into the old, dispiritedly lit coaches waiting for us, slumped into the uncomfortable green seats, and no one said much until we were miles away. When we did speak, it was about aviation training programs, and brothers in the service, and requirements for enlistment, and the futility of Devon, and how we would never have war stories to tell our grandchildren, and how long the war might last, and who ever heard of studying dead languages at a time like this? Quackenbush took advantage of a break in this line of conversation to announce that he would certainly stay at Devon through the year, however half-cocked others might rush off. He elaborated without encouragement, citing the advantages of Devon's physical hardening program and of a high school diploma when he did, in good time, reach basic training. He, for one, would advance into the army step by step.
"You, for one,"
echoed someone contemptuously.
"You are one,"
someone else said.
"Which army, Quackenbush? Mussolini's? Nah, he's a kraut. He's a kraut spy! How many rails did you sabotage today, Quackenbush? I thought they interned all Quackenbushes the day after Pearl Harbor."
To which Brinker added,
"They didn't find him. He hid his light under a Quackenbush."
We were all tired at the end of that day. Walking back to the school grounds from the railroad station in the descending darkness, we overtook a lone figure sliding along the snow-covered edge of the street.
"Will you look at Lapellier?" began Brinker irritably. "Who does he think he is, the abominable snowman?"
"He's just been out skiing around," I said quickly. I didn't want to see today's strained tempers exploding on Leper. Then, as we came up beside him,
"Did you find the dam, Leper?"
He turned his head slowly, without breaking his forward movement of alternately planted poles and thrust skis, rhythmically but feebly continuous, like a homemade piston engine's.
"You know what? I did find it."
His smile was wide and unfocused, as though not for me alone, but for anyone and anything which wished to share his pleasure with him.
"And it was really interesting to see. I took some pictures of it.
If they come out, I'll bring them over and show you.
What dam is that?
Brinker asked me.
It's a, well, a little dam up the river he knows about, I said.
I don't know of any dam up the river.
Well, it's not in the Devon itself. It's in one of the tributaries.
Tributaries? To the Devon?
You know, a little creek or something.
He knit his brows in mystification.
What kind of a dam is this, anyway?
Well, he couldn't be put off with a half-story. It's a beaver dam. Brinker's shoulders fell under the weight of this news.
That's the kind of a place I'm in, with a world war going on. A school for photographers of beaver dams.
The beaver never appeared himself,
Lepper offered. Brinker turned elaborately toward him.
Didn't he really?
No, but I guess I was pretty clumsy getting close to it, so he might have heard me and been frightened.
Well!
Brinker's expansive, dazed tone suggested that here was one of life's giant ironies.
There you are.
Yes,
agreed Lepper after a thoughtful pause.
There you are.
Here we are,
I said, pulling Brinker around the corner we had reached, which led to our dormitory.
So long, Lepper. Glad you found it. Oh!
He raised his voice after us.
How was your day? How did the work go?
Just like a stag at eve, Brinker roared back. It was a winter wonderland every minute.
And out of the side of his mouth to me,
everybody in this place is either a draft-dodging kraut or a...
The scornful force of his tone turned the word into a curse.
A naturalist.
He grabbed my arm agitatedly.
I'm giving it up. I'm going to enlist tomorrow.
I felt a thrill when he said it. This was the logical climax of the whole misbegotten day, this whole out-of-joint term at Devon. I think I'd been waiting for a long time for someone to say this so that I could entertain these decisive words myself. To enlist, to slam the door impulsively on the past, to shed everything down to my last bit of clothing, to break the pattern of my life, that complex design I had been weaving since birth with all its dark threads, its unexplainable symbols set against a conventional background of domestic white and schoolboy blue. All those tangled strands which require the dexterity of a virtuoso to keep flowing. I yearned to take giant military shears to it. Snap! Bitten off in an instant, and nothing left in my hands but spools of khaki, which could weave only a plain, flat, khaki design, however twisted they might be. Not that it would be a good life. The war would be deadly, all right. But I was used to finding something deadly in things that attracted me. There was always something deadly lurking in anything I wanted. Anything I loved. And if it wasn't there, as for example with Phineas, then I put it there myself. But in the war, there was no question about it at all. It was there. I separated from Brinker in the quadrangle, since one of his clubs was meeting, and he could not go back to the dormitory yet.
I've got to preside at the meeting of the Golden Fleece Debating Society tonight,
he said in a tone of amazed contempt.
The Golden Fleece Debating Society! We're mad here! All mad!
And he went off, raving to himself in the dark. It was a night made for hard thoughts. Sharp stars pierced singly through the blackness. Not sweeps of them, or clusters, or Milky Ways, as there might have been in the south, but single, chilled points of light, as unromantic as knife blades. Devon, muffled under the gentle occupation of the snow, was dominated by them. The cold Yankee stars ruled this night. They did not invoke in me thoughts of God, or sailing before the mast, or some great love as crowded night skies at home had done. I thought instead, in the light of those cold points, of the decision facing me. Why go through the motions of getting an education and watch the war slowly chip away at the one thing I had loved here? The peace, the measureless, careless peace of the Devon summer. Others, the Quackenbushes of this world, could calmly watch the war approach them and jump into it at the last and most advantageous instant, as though buying into the stock market. But I couldn't. There was no one to stop me but myself. Putting aside soft reservations about what I owed Devon and my duty to my parents and so on, I reckoned my responsibilities by the light of the unsentimental night sky and knew that I owed no one anything. I owed it to myself to meet this crisis in my life when I chose, and I chose now. I bounced zestfully up the dormitory stairs, perhaps because my mind still retained the image of the sharp night stars, those few fixed points of light in the darkness. Perhaps because of that, the warm yellow light streaming from under my own door came as such a shock. It was a simple case of a change of expectation. The light should have been off. Instead, as though alive itself, it poured in a thin yellow slab of brightness from under the door, illuminating the dust and splinters of the hall floor. I grabbed the knob and swung open the door. He was seated in my chair at the desk, bending down to adjust the gross encumbrance of his leg, so that only the familiar ears set close against his head were visible, and his short-cut brown hair. He looked up with a provocative grin. "Hi, pal! Where's the brass band?" Everything that had happened throughout the day faded like that first false snowfall of the winter. Phineas was back. Chapter 8.
"I can see I never should have left you alone," Phineas went on before I could recover from the impact of finding him there. "Where did you get those clothes?"
His bright, indignant eyes swept from my battered gray cap, down the frayed sweater and paint-stained pants to a pair of clodhoppers.
"You don't have to advertise like that. We all know you're the worst-dressed man in the class."
"I've been working, that's all. These are just work clothes."
"In the boiler room?"
"On the railroad, shoveling snow."
He sat back in the chair.
"Shoveling railroad snow. Well, that makes sense. We always did that first term."
I pulled off the sweater, under which I was wearing a rain slicker I used to go sailing in, a kind of canvas sack. Phineas just studied it in wordless absorption.
"I like the cut of it," he finally murmured.
I pulled that off, revealing an army fatigue shirt my brother had given me.
"Very topical," said Phineas through his teeth.
After that came off, there was just my undershirt, stained with sweat. He smiled at it for a while, and then said, as he heaved himself out of the chair,
"There. You should have worn that all day, just that. That has real taste. The rest of your outfit was just gilding that lily of a sweatshirt."
"Glad to hear you like it."
"Not at all,"
he replied ambiguously, reaching for a pair of crutches which leaned against the desk. I took the sight of this all right. I had seen him on crutches the year before when he broke his ankle playing football. At Devon, crutches had almost as many athletic associations as shoulder pads. And I had never seen an invalid whose skin glowed with such health, accenting the sharp clarity of his eyes, or one who used his arms and shoulders on crutches as though on parallel bars, as though he would do a somersault on them if he felt like it. Phineas vaulted across the room to his cot, yanked back the spread, and then groaned,
"Oh, Christ! It's not made up! What is all this crap about no maids?"
"No maids," I said. "After all, there is a war on. It's not much of a sacrifice when you think of people starving and being bombed and all the other things." My unselfishness was responding properly to the influences of 1942. In these past months, Phineas and I had grown apart on this. I felt a certain disapproval of him for grumbling about a lost luxury with a war on. "After all," I repeated, "there is a war on."
"Is there?"
he murmured absently. I didn't pay any attention. He was always speaking when his thoughts were somewhere else, asking rhetorical questions and echoing other people's words. I found some sheets and made up his bed for him. He wasn't a bit sensitive about being helped, not a bit like an invalid striving to seem independent. I put this on the list of things to include when I said some prayers, the first in a long time, that night in bed. Now that Phineas was back, it seemed time to start saying prayers again. After the lights went out, the special quality of my silence let him know that I was saying them, and he kept quiet for approximately 3 minutes. Then he began to talk. He never went to sleep without talking first,